Chapter 22. Sandra Grosvenor pressed her lips into a tight line as color flooded her cheeks.
"We had a deal," she said.
James Abrenio sat tall in the guest chair opposite her desk, his hands folded atop his crossed legs. His intent was to project neutrality, peace, but it felt a little like reading a newspaper in the middle of a gang fight.
"I thought we did," he said. "No, James, you told me we had a deal. Based on your word, I told the Attorney General that we had a deal. Immunity and witness protection. Do you know how many people that involves?"
"Let's be fair, Sandy," Abrenio said. "You can't reasonably hold me accountable for people you spoke to before you should have."
"I did that, Counselor, because you told me that it was a sure thing."
"There's no such thing. But none of this is relevant because I am not now, nor was I ever, the decision-maker here." Grosvenor leaned forward against her desk, clearly preparing angry words, but then she stopped herself. Abrenio could almost hear her brain churning as she gathered her emotions. Grosvenor's office was a study in contradictions. The permanent parts of the interior, the paneled walls and wainscoting, the polished hardwoods and towering windows, were the stuff of a Hollywood set, designed to project old-school legal authority. As the sitting U.S. attorney, Grosvenor had chosen to furnish the old-school room with decidedly new-school furniture. Abrenio would call it Danish modern, or maybe just cold and uncomfortable. When she'd finished wrestling with her emotions, Grosvenor leaned back again and in a calm voice asked,
"What happened here, James?"
"My official answer is I don't know. Connie was never enthralled by the idea of the plea deal, but I thought I had sold her on it. I helped her see that immunity and WITSEC were the best options long-term for her children. That was late yesterday afternoon. By this morning, she'd changed her mind. I guess she got scared."
"Scared of what?"
Abrenio piffed. "Come on, Sandy. Put yourself in her shoes. Her husband is dead. Her kids are separated from her. And she's staring down the barrel of a really shitty forever. What's not to be scared of?" Grosvenor took her time processing his words.
"You said that's your official answer. What's your unofficial answer?"
"You mean the one for which I have no evidence but only a gut feeling?" The U.S. attorney did her best to fake a smile.
"Yeah, that one."
"I think somebody got to her," Abrenio said. "I think someone told her about her missing kids." Grosvenor's features hardened.
"I seem to remember you having strong feelings that she should know."
"Sandy, if you're going to keep slinging accusations my way, this meeting is over. You forget that I don't owe you a thing. You forget that I'm here doing Uncle Sam a favor for a fraction of the fee I could otherwise be making. There will not be another warning. Next shot you fire, I'm just walking away." Abrenio had been planning for this moment, and he could see that his words had hit the way he'd wanted them to. Grosvenor tented her fingers for a few seconds, and then she spun her ultra-modern high-backed ergonomic mesh chair around to face the window behind her.
"You make a fair point," she said, "and I apologize. What makes you think that she knows?"
Abrenio had no intention of talking to the back of her chair. He remained silent until she spun back around to face him.
"Hi," he said with a sarcastic finger wave. "She summoned me."
"So? You're her attorney."
"We were scheduled to meet at 11, Abrenio explained. "I'd spent last night reading over the plea deal, making sure that everything was what it should be, and I was going to review it with her and have her sign it. Then at 7 o'clock, straight up, I woke up to a phone call from the prison telling me that she was insisting on seeing me right away. Who was on the phone? I don't know. He gave his name, but after waking up like that, I was lucky to remember my own. He apologized, then told me that Connie needed to speak with me right away. Did he say why? I asked, and he said he was just the messenger. So I hauled my ass out of bed, showered, and drove out to Murder Mountain. Connie arrived at the interview room at about the same time I did, and she looked terrible. What does terrible mean?
Haggard, he said. Like you expect someone to look after they've received news they don't know how to process. She didn't even want to sit. She just said the deal is off. Those were her words. The deal is off.
Why? Abrenio had asked. What happened?
Connie hugged herself, her hands clutching the opposite shoulders.
I just don't want to go through with it, the whole deal.
Abrenio stood and gestured to the other chair.
Please, have a seat. Let's talk this through.
There's nothing to talk about, she said. I've been stewing over this all night, and I've just changed my mind.
She swiped at tears.
It's my life, and it's my decision. Don't forget that I know my rights and my choices.
Please, Connie, Abrenio coaxed. Please, have a seat. You summoned me all the way in here, so the least you could do is show me the courtesy of a little FaceTime.
Keeping her eyes cast to the floor, Connie haltingly walked the 3 steps to the immovable chair and sat. He thought it was interesting that the thought of inconveniencing him seemed to get through to her. It was equally interesting that she sat on the very front edge, as if ready to bolt at the slightest provocation.
As your attorney, he said, I owe you total honesty, blunt honesty. So here it is, Connie. I think you're lying to me. And here's why. We were scheduled to see each other anyway in just a couple of hours. You could have blown me off then. Instead, here we are.
Connie stared, unblinking, at a spot on the table that appeared to be about 5 inches in front of her lawyer. The way the muscles of her jaw churned, she might have been chewing gum. He continued,
"The natural thing for you to say here is that you didn't want me to waste any more of my time. But if that were truly the case, that would have been the message. But it wasn't. You brought me out anyway.
Do you want to know what I think?"
That got her attention. She rolled her gaze to meet his.
"I think you have something to tell me, and you're trying to screw up the courage to do it."
Tears welled in her lids and spilled onto her cheeks. This time she made no effort to stop them or to wipe them away. They splashed onto the stainless steel surface of the table. Abrenio watched her in silence for the better part of a minute. In that time, she only looked away a couple of times. He felt that she was trying to tell him something, perhaps trying to communicate telepathically, and he suspected that he already knew what the message was.
"Are you afraid of talking to me?" he asked. Her head twitched just a little. He read the movement as a yes. "Did someone get to you? Deliver news to you that scared you?" Another twitch. "A visitor?" Connie stared. He leaned in much closer. "You didn't move there," he whispered.
"Does that mean no?"
Twitch.
"Was it another inmate?"
"Nothing." Abrenio scowled. Not a visitor, and not an inmate. Who else was there? He felt his eyes grow wide. Was it a guard? This time the twitch was a full-fledged nod, and her lip quivered. He reached across the table and opened his hand for hers. She presented them both.
"Is it about your boys?"
Abrenio asked.
She mouthed, "Yes," but there was no sound.
"Did a guard threaten them?" Connie turned nearly backward in her chair as she looked back at the door.
"You're safe in here," Abrenio said. "What you say with me stays with me."
His stomach flipped a little as he heard his own words. This was not his playground. He had no idea what kind of recording equipment they might have in place. Just because he didn't repeat what she told him didn't mean that others weren't listening.
"The guard didn't actually threaten them," she whispered. "He delivered a message from someone else. He seemed very uncomfortable delivering it. I'd say he looked scared."
"Who was it?"
"I won't tell you that," she said.
"Why?"
"You lied to me, didn't you?"
Connie's face looked startled, as if the question had just popped into her head. Abrenio waited for the rest.
"You knew that Ryder and Jeff were kidnapped," she said. "You've known it for some time. I knew you were holding something back last time we talked."
Obfuscation made no sense at this point.
"Yes," he said.
"Well, no. I knew that they'd gone missing. I suspected that they'd been kidnapped, but I didn't know that. I still don't know that."
Connie's sadness dissolved to anger, but she kept her voice low.
"You've put them in danger. They could be killed."
"No," Abrenio said. "That's bullshit. I'll stipulate that they are in danger, but I didn't put them there. I'll even cop to withholding information that I probably should have shared with you, but in the absence of hard evidence, the plea deal was and is the best option for your family."
He let that sink in for a few seconds.
"The message you got, was it from Armand Cortez? Is he the one who nabbed your kids?"
Another panicky look over her shoulder.
"Oh my God," she said. "How did my life come to this?"
"Focus. If it was Cortez, then that's all the more reason to go ahead with the plea deal."
Connie brought her hands to her face as if to squeeze away the fear.
"No,"
she said.
"It's far worse than that."
As Abrenio replayed to Grosvenor the details of his jailhouse confab with Connie Kendall, he decided to leave out the part about the chemical weapons. His client was in deep enough legal waters without having to worry about that, too. "What do you plan to do to find and protect the children now?
Did she give you the note?"
Abrenio shook his head. "The note instructed her to destroy it. She tore it up and flushed it down the toilet."
"And she refused to identify the guard?"
"How big a list is there to choose from?" Abrenio replied. "Only a couple of them have the authority to interact with her."
"When did this meeting happen?" Grosvenor asked.
"With the guard, I mean."
"In the wee hours," Abrenio said.
"Just check the surveillance footage and you'll have your man."
"Did she tell you exactly what the note said about her children?"
"I didn't press for a quote," Abrenio said. That wasn't entirely true, but he didn't want to open the door to her involvement with the weapons shipments. But the gist was that they'd taken the children as collateral to keep Connie from revealing secrets about what they were doing on behalf of their clients. Grosvenor blew a dismissive puff of air.
"Clients, huh? That's a rather generous term for a cartel mule."
Abrenio didn't rise to the bait, but he squirmed at the thought of allowing her to assume the untruth that Cortez was the man who ordered the kidnappings and killings. Not that the C-Square hadn't ordered its share of both over the years.
"This is an emergency, Sandy, yet you don't seem to be moved by it. You've got to recover her children."
She spun in her chair again to face once more out the window.
"It would help if you had seen the note," she said.
It would help if we had the name of the guard who presented it to her. Or if we had even a single piece of evidence that what you say is true actually happened.
Damn it, Sandy! Will you at least do me the courtesy of looking at me while we speak?
When she returned, she looked annoyed, or maybe she looked bored.
I don't understand your resistance to protecting two minor children. If you can find them and vouch for their security, Connie Kendall will give you everything you want. Will she, James?
She tented her fingers again, a gesture that he was coming to despise.
Or will that deal be another launching spot for a promise she doesn't intend to keep? Do you know what I think?
She leaned way forward, elbows on the Lucite desktop, fingers still tented.
I think this is one big delaying tactic. I think she's buying time for Armand Cortez to pull some miracle out of his behind.
Abrenio hadn't seen this side of Sandy Grosvenor before. Could it be that she really didn't care? Was it possible to prosecute so many people, build so many cases to prove guilt, and inevitably to conceal innocence, that the humanity didn't matter anymore?
Suppose you're wrong, Sandy. Suppose the evidence is there and you can't see it, in part because you're choosing not even to try.
Suppose Connie Kendall is telling the truth, and those children truly are in harm's way.
They're children, Sandy.
Her features remained hard as stone.
Then they're safe, aren't they? She said. Your client isn't saying a word, and I'm going to do everything in my power to send her to the death chamber.
It was the viciousness more than anything that startled him. No one is safe, Sandy. Not in the hands of... His mind flashed back to something Grosvenor had said earlier in the discussion.
Did you say that you told the Attorney General that Connie was going to sign the plea deal?
I did.
His stomach flipped.
Did you tell her personally, or did you tell her through an aide?
Through her personal assistant,
Grosvenor said.
The Attorney General is a busy... Jesus, Sandy! Don't you realize what you've done?
He rose to his feet, one hand to his mouth, the other to his ear, a gesture of burgeoning panic.
You've killed those boys!
Oh, for God's sake, James, don't be so melodramatic.
He was done. This was a lost cause. Jeffrey and Ryder Kendall were in serious, mortal danger, and he had to figure out what to do about it. Maybe if he shared what Connie knew about shipments of chemical weapons into the country, he could whet the U.S. attorney's appetite for compromise, for help. That would take time. He didn't have time. Those boys didn't have time. All he needed in addition to a slowed clock was an idea.
I'm out,
he said. He pivoted and headed for her door.
Out of what?
Grosvenor said, rising out of her own chair.
Where are you going?
He didn't bother to answer. He didn't think she deserved one. The Albert V. Bryan United States Courthouse in Alexandria, Virginia, was an imposing structure, standing on an urban island on Courthouse Square. This section of Old Town was nearly 200 years younger than the kitschy and oh-so-precious colonial structures that lined the Potomac River on the Virginia side. And though the architects of the business development did their best to pull off a look of colonial charm, the odds were stacked against them when the buildings were 10 stories tall. Like all the other hundreds of federal buildings within a few miles of Washington, D.C., this one teemed with security. In addition to the steady stream of armed cops and federal agents who poured in and out on their way to testify to the courtrooms housed inside. That swarm of law enforcement officers and the lobby's magnetometers kept Jonathan and his team outside instead of inside, spread out to keep an eye on the rental Ford Escape that a lawyer named James Abrenio had been driving since his arrival in town from Michigan a few days ago. Somehow, Venice had been able to dig up the fact that he was the lawyer of record for Connie Kendall, and that he wasn't local. Abrenio had chosen to park underground, which made surveillance more of a challenge than Jonathan wanted it to be. People were smart to be paranoid in so densely populated an area, even more so given the proximity to the courthouse and other federal goings-on. They were likewise smart to be wary of strangers they see hanging around in underground parking garages. The challenge for the Security Solutions team was to see without being seen and then move in on their subject quickly enough to cut off any escape, yet not so quickly as to trigger his defenses. They didn't want to hurt him, quite the opposite, in fact, but he had no way of knowing that. The takedown would require finesse, which is why he'd assigned boxers to park the Batmobile in as dark a spot as he could find, as close to Abrenio's rental as possible, with Gale sitting next to him. Out on the street, Jonathan and Dawkins watched the courthouse exits from opposing sides of the building, while in Fisherman's Cove, Mother Hen watched the video feeds from inside the building. As she'd explained it to Jonathan, she only had limited access to the feeds on the courtroom levels, but she had unrestricted views of who was coming and going. She hoped that her access to facial recognition software would take some of the pressure off of them to scan every face they saw. They'd been in place for well over half an hour, maybe 45 minutes, having picked up Abrenio's rental about 15 miles outside Alexandria. The company from which the Michigan lawyer had rented his car had installed GPS trackers in all its fleet vehicles. Once Venice had found the vehicle, make, model, and VIN, she'd been able to track his progress at every turn until he entered the garage. From there, they just had to park and wait. Jonathan could think of two or three good reasons for Abrenio to make the drive all the way in from West Virginia to meet in the courthouse, but none of them mattered. What did matter was that they knew where he was, and he'd soon have no choice but to listen to what they had to say. The radio bud popped in Jonathan's ear, which meant it popped in everyone else's ear, too.
"Scorpion, Mother Hen," Benice said. "Your target is leaving the building via the doors on the western side. He's passing through the security barriers now. He should be visible to you in about a minute."
"I copy," Jonathan said. He set his radio to Vox to keep his hands free. "That's my side. Big guy and gunslinger, you know what to do?"
"On our way,"
Boxer said. "Thor, you hang back 50 yards or so until he's fully committed to the parking lot. Then close the distance."
"Copy." "One other thing," Venice said. "I don't know how meaningful this is, but it feels important to me. One of the employees of the prison where Connie Kendall is being held just turned up dead. His name was Sid Hoffman. Pretty senior among the correctional officers. A lieutenant, I think."
Jonathan felt the bloom of dread.
"Any word on cause of death?"
"Nothing definitive," she said. "But the police are treating it as a homicide."
"If it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck,"
Boxers said.
"Okay, team," Jonathan groaned. "This shit's about to get interesting."